Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Of that incident. Now, singer, songwriter and now actor, Brian Kennedy. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. How are you?
Very, very good. Now, you're here with us to share five, just five songs.
Just five.
Just five.
Which very tricky, isn't it, to pick your favourite five?
Very, very tricky if you're a singer-songwriter. But these are a life in five songs, songs that hold a very special meaning for you. And you grew up in a busy, noisy house in Belfast during the Troubles. So I'm wondering, what was your sort of original soundscape, or what is your kind of earliest memory of music as a child?
Well, honestly, truthfully, the soundscape was one of war, was, you know, bombs and guns and soldiers and all of that stuff. But somehow in the midst of all of that cacophony, you know, music would kind of get through because we had the safety sometimes of the television that was never, I'd say the TV was on more than the fire, you know, a kind of household like that. So when Top of the Pops started, say Saturday morning TV started, you would kind of hear things. But the first thing I really ever heard was our local shop, one of those, you know, shops that sold, you know, school uniforms and rat traps and bread. And of course, on a washing line, vinyl albums. And there was this one that really stood out to me. It shows you how wee I was. I'd be looking up at this kind of line thinking, there was an album that had Ireland in the shape of an old woman with a spinning wheel. And that record was by The Flying Column. And there was a song that played over and over again called Four Green Fields. Now, I just thought it was about four fields. What did I know? I was a little kid. But of course, it was about the place I was standing in.
Yeah, because what's really actually interesting about your first choice, which is Four Green Fields, is that it's a political song. It's a song about the division of Ireland. And I think it was William Butler Yeats and Lady Gregory, the lyrics they took from it was actually from their play, Kathleen Hulham, which was way back in 1902 or something. And then that kind of finds its way into the Four Green Fields. And that's what I was curious about for your first song. Did it reflect political consciousness at an early age, or was it just this mad Irish woman hanging from an album
line? I thought she was beautiful. I didn't think she was mad. Mm. I thought it was just the idea that somehow, because people kept referring to Ireland as Mother Ireland, or Mother Tongue, things like that. And so you have this image of a very feminine image. Of course, she had a spinning wheel, so she was spinning all kinds of things. And, you know, in those days, music was still so magical. I didn't know how it worked. I didn't know how records were made. And vinyl, of course, as you know, it was such a big record, especially if you're a little kid like me at that time. So it was just full of all of this mystery and magic. And I drove this poor man, Patsy Crawford, his shop, be like, oh, put it on, Patsy, put it on. It was the only one I was interested in. So how extraordinary. I've had these times in my life, you know, when it's like the future is waving at me. Mm. And so then many years later, when I recorded my first song, Captured, I did a version of Four Green Fields as a B-side. Did you know?
I did not know that.
Yes, I did.
Will we have a listen to it?
I'd
Let's have
to.
A listen to it. This is Four Green Fields, The Flying Column.
What did I have? Said the fine old woman. What did I have? This proud old woman did say, I had four green fields. But strangers came and tried to take them from me. I had fine, strong sons. They fought to save my jewels. They fought and they died.
Incredible. I hadn't realised you had paid tribute to that sort of very, very early childhood memory. Obviously, you know, as you've referenced, growing up in Belfast and indeed other parts of the north at that time, well, you were on the Falls Road.
I was on the Falls Road.
You were at the epicentre of it all. And I think I've heard you previously say that there was violence both inside and outside of the house.
Yeah. Violence everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
And how did you cope with that as a young child, that turbulence in both your inner and your outer worlds, if that's
I mean, you just do, don't you? I didn't realize the power of it and how powerless it makes you feel, because we had it everywhere. It was at school. It was the church. It was, I mean, our own parents. When I look back now with adult eyes and ears, I see just how much PTSD there was around, that they had been through so much themselves. And I remember the first time I ever went to the Shankill Road, for example. Of course, those lovely people, I went over to sing, and those lovely people were just like us, exactly the same as us. We women and we men just getting about their lives, somehow getting caught up in this kind of civil rights movement. And certainly, like I say, I was surrounded by, people who just were treated so abominably, especially the women, the men were, especially Catholic men at that time. Even though I was a kid, I didn't really know what it was, but I felt it all the time. I felt the injustice all the time.
And did you feel, when you reference that kind of, you know, that turbulence inside and outside, did you feel like an outsider in your own family?
I must have done, you know, because my absolute fantasy when things were particularly low, I'd sit on the step outside and fantasize that my real parents would come along in a car and they would pick me up and put me on the back seat, cover me in a blanket. I had it all worked out. And then they would drive off and take me to my real home, because somehow there'd been a mix up at birth. I convinced myself of this. And I think also, just rather unkindly, people would say to me, you know, you're not part of this family. You don't tell anybody you're my brother. Things like that at school. So because I seem to have had this kind of feminine quality. And as you know, historically, you know, that one of the awful things about that kind of thing is that the worst thing you could be as a boy is a girl. And how interesting that that's all flipped on its head these days.
And the worst thing you can be is different.
Yes.
You live in those houses. I grew up in one as well.
Yeah.
There's lots of children and a big family.
Yeah.
It's very hard to hide in small spaces, you know, like, I'm a twin, so we were like together.
You're
the whole
a twin.
Time. Yeah, so, but you know, how did you, I suppose, protect your inner life or your secret life?
Yeah.
And, you know, when they're just big congested.
Well, I remember hearing an interview by the late Nuala O'Fuilleann, and they said to her, so do you go to your cottage in the West if you want to have some private time? She goes, no, I drop into myself. She says, anybody out there listening from a big family will know what I'm talking about. You develop this real ability to drop into yourself. So I could be in the middle of absolute chaos, but I've dropped so far into myself that's my secret place. That's my wee place where I go. And I think I just developed that really powerfully over the years.
So was it where you were retreating?
200%.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I just had a way of doing it. I'd either get under a table or I'd get under a bed, sometimes physically. Just somewhere that was, you know, that was an unusual spot. Behind the sofa. Again, this was always when I was a tiny kid. And I was able to just be still and drop into myself. And then I had my own world to myself.
Yeah, which, you know, I'm sure there could be any amount of analysis of what happens when you do with that. You have been estranged from your family for many years.
Yeah. Decades now.
How do you find peace with that?
Well, I think that's the very word. I mean, you either put up with, you know, just how unpeaceful it is and try and navigate that journey, or you go, you know what, I choose peace. And in order to get at something, you just have to cut certain people out of your life. It sounds very harsh, I know. But for me, certainly, there was only two choices. Either do that and have a peaceful life, or somehow just bring along all of this awful baggage that doesn't seem to
And is that a journey? Like, do you have empathy or sympathy now?
Yeah.
Again, coming from that, you know, you're an adult. We've been through life, you know.
I mean, what I really see very powerfully is just how much PTSD there was around, and nobody gave it that title because that was far too fancy. I see that both my parents came from difficult situations and then ended up with six kids in the middle of the Falls Road at the worst time in history. So they didn't get relief, I don't think. It's hard to speak for them. My dad's passed on now. My mother's still alive. And there are, you know, I see now throughout history just how hard it was on every moment of every day.
And so much of
to
that
feel
is
safe.
Being born out now with intergenerational trauma,
That's
all of
right.
that research. Can I ask you, I'm trying to imagine this small child who could retreat into a world.
Uh-huh.
Where did the dream of becoming a singer come from? Was it the corner shop or
one of the things I used to do was harmonise with ambulances and fire engines if they would come down, which they did a lot on the Falls Road. And, you know, we used to have to queue up.
You would have been very close to the Royal, so in a constant
really
cacophony.
Close to the Royal. And then if I was going into town, we had to queue up at these turnstiles. You might remember that.
Of course.
In order to be allowed into this. It's the only place in the city it happened, in West Belfast. So standing around in that rain or in that sunshine, whatever the weather, waiting to be questioned by the police, I would hear an ambulance. And my reaction to that was, oh, that's a good, you know, because it was the Nina Nina days before the Miami Vice ones. And so I would think of a harmony, a higher one, a lower one. I mean, why on earth did I do that? I've no idea. But there is a little theory that says, you know, whenever I feel afraid, I whistle a happy tune. You know, it's one of those kind of coping mechanisms, yeah. I think. And it's a child's way of doing that.
Was that a courageous thing to do as a child and then kind of going into adolescence, having that dream, given the context we were, you know, we're in? Like, when I always think that, you know, when big bands came to the North, it was such a vindication of you know, of who we were.
So that's right.
When you were going as a child and a teenager into that, how outlandish did it feel, or did you just feel you had this dream that needed to be fed?
I had all of those things, I think, at once. And certainly I'd experienced so much misogyny anyway, like do anything just to do with girls, all of that nonsense, you know. And so I remember putting my name up for a kind of a choir singing competition thing at school and shaking while I was doing it because I knew I was going to be doing this. But the thing is, I was ridiculed anyway. So I just thought to myself, oh, well, sure, you know, how awful can it be? It was pretty awful, I must say. But I stood up and I sang a version of Annie's song, John Denver's Annie's song. Now, my voice was shaking because I was so nervous, but I was more overpowered by how my friend Eddie Reader would say to me, do you think that you lose yourself on stage? And I said, no, I find
you
myself.
You find yourself on stage.
And that's what happened, I think.
Tell me about your connection to Kate Bush. Why is she such an important artist to you?
Oh, we could be here all day. How long do you have? I mean, one of the first artists that I really was just entranced by, we snooked into my friend's oldest brother's, you know, bedroom where he had a vinyl player in the 70s. The Kick Inside had just been released. And the minute the crackle of the vinyl started and we hear those first piano notes and then she sings, I hear him before I go to sleep. It was like she was singing directly to me only through that speaker. And little did I know I'd grow up and get to know her a little bit and have dinner with her at her house. And she
came. You sent your first album to her, didn't
you? I sent my very first album. That was the deal I did with myself. If I ever get to make an album, I'm sending it to Kate because
she
was one of the reasons.
Huh? Did she obviously responded?
She sure did.
Yes,
I still have the card. And I didn't realise who it was from because it said Brian Wennedy. She did her K's like a W. But I then realised who it was and I ended up having dinner and meeting her a few times and a spectacular woman. So The Man with the Child in His Eyes is a song full of innocence like I kind of was at that time, sort of.
Well, let's have a look. This is Brian Kennedy's second song. It's Kate Bush and The Man with the Child in His Eyes.
And here I am again, my girl.
Voice and her orchestration. It's always just...
I mean, apparently she was 16 when she wrote that song.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. No, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
When you did start to dream about becoming a singer, when and who did you share those dreams with?
I mean, I didn't really. I mean, the only outlet for a boy like me was in a local choir, in the chapel in the church. So I started to do I'd wait behind and I'd meet the other singers and actually, bizarrely, it was actually my dad who had a running mate called Charlie, whose daughter was in the choir. So that was in St. John's, but I was in St. Paul's choir as well, and also in Clonard choir briefly, just anywhere I could. But again, let's not underestimate how dangerous it was. Sometimes I couldn't even leave the house. I certainly couldn't leave the Falls Road because there was shooting and bombing and all that kind of thing. But slowly but surely, I was able to find my way in it. But that was the only outlet. Now, and then my eldest brother...
Great training, though, as well.
And in a way it was, even though it wasn't music that excited me, apart from, say, Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, maybe the Bach tune, because it was so beautiful. But I wanted something a bit more exciting because my other outlet, of course, was the television, Top of the Pops, people coming on there, Boy George, Culture Club. I was a real kid.
Did you record the tape for the
Record
Top
a tape of the
Pops?
Charts coming up. And the first time I ever heard ABBA, for example, all that harmony, all of that joy in that record. I remember seeing them on the Eurovision. And again, little did I know, my future was waving at me.
No. And again, like, I mean, obviously it was a feature of your teenage years for many of us. But your next song pick actually is ABBA.
It is
Dancing Queen. Well, let's have a little listen. Sure, why not?
Friday night and the lights are low.
I love doing a life in five songs because it's amazing when people's kind of disco tracks come in, they just start shaking their shoulders.
You picture yourself throwing yourself around the bedroom to that.
Yeah. Did you, look, I mean, some things did break through during that time and music was one of them. Look, I mean, did you go to discos? Were you
No, I was too kind of young for that. And like I say, they were rare enough occasions just because the unrest was at an all-time high. But no, my sister did and my brothers, some of my older brothers did. I was just a wee bit too young for that scene. But so therefore, I had my own little, you know, private disco. And that was a great thing about music back then. It really seemed private and all of your own and all encompassing. I remember that we had a wee dance set record player for a while before it got smashed a bit, of course. And Dancing Queen, I mean, I suppose the clues were there early for a young person who's a young gay person, maybe trying to imagine what it's like to, the way they looked, the way they, the joy in that record.
It's
that's the thing that
joy.
Overwhelms me even now. It's so full of joy. Yeah. And we had so little of it as kids. Yeah. You just kind of think, I don't know why. It's like when you hear Michael Jackson for the first time off the wall or something. It's just full of joy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. No, it definitely is one of those tracks. And I can almost see you being transported back to your teenage years.
My Candlewick bedspread.
Look, you've spoken of, obviously, the turbulence and trauma of your childhood in Belfast. And look, you know, just looking since Monday night, you know, when you see the riots and the violence and that's happening, and not just in Ballymena, but in other areas that's flared up in other areas.
And
that young, you know, Olympian who was training in the swimming pool just saying, we thought those days were gone.
Like, I know.
When you see that now, having experienced what you did growing up, what are you thinking?
Honestly, PTSD straight away. I feel traumatized. I feel helpless. You look, especially when you're looking at. I mean, I imagine what it would be like if people had phones and the internet when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. The things that people would have seen on camera that I saw as a little boy. So I suppose it kind of, you know, rattles that kind of part of me. And also just the, even though we have great voices of reason like Kneecap around and all of that, you still have for some reason this addiction to war, addiction to punishing people because they're different. I mean, how short a memory do we have? Every single Irish person that I know went into the world looking for help, went into the world, to myself included, to better their lives. So, I mean, I don't understand why somebody looks down on somebody else because they're a foreigner. We're all foreigners, for goodness sake. And to terrorise children in their own home and things like that. Oh, it's just the humans can be so awful when they want to be. My heart goes out to all of those people. It really does.
You spoke there, Brian Kendi, just about, you know, we all sort of moved on to better our lives. And you did move. You made a big move, as many people did during that time, to London.
But
you went with the intent of being a singer.
So
with a very, very clear ambition. Yes. Were you confident that you would make it, or how did you make it?
Oh, it's just, I suppose I was on the verge of delusion of every single day. I mean, I think that certainly I'm a big visualizer. So I would visualize myself being successful. I would visualize myself having my posters around London where there were other people's posters. So there was an ambitious side to me, definitely.
And also, when was this? When did you move
over? So in 85, July 11th, 1985. Which is 40 years, you know, almost. I know it's a shocking thing. But 2 days after I arrived, what was on the TV, on the pulled-out TV on the back of our wee back garden in a squat I was living with in Tottenham with a bunch of other Irish fellas and girls, was Live Aid. July 13th. I was in the country 48 hours and it seemed like the whole world was having a party. The lovely band called The Adventures were 2 doors up from us. So we were able to illegally squat 2 doors down from them in Tottenham near Lordship Lane. And it was, do you remember how hot that summer was? It was the hottest summer on record. So there we were out the back, pulled all the extension cords we could find, watching a wee TV in the back garden. I didn't even drink then, so I was drinking fizzy water or something. Everybody else was drinking all kinds of things. And just the joy of it. And in particular, when U2 came on. I mean, of course, Queen.
Because it would have been very challenging for many people from the island of Ireland in London and other parts of the UK.
Oh my God,
the
racism.
Time.
I mean, talk about what's happening in the north now. I was detained at the airport loads of times. I was spat at in the underground when people heard my northern accent. This is 85, so not that long ago. And really, we didn't have any other people, you know, fighting our corner. Every time people thought of us, they thought of us as terrorists first and all of that stuff. Now, obviously, that has changed dramatically in some ways. But certainly through the, you know, through the lens of music, we suddenly had a wonderful interpretation in the shape of, at that point, U2 and Bob Geldof, of course. But that was Southern Ireland. But even so, we still
And the music at that time, you know, and one of them you've chosen, but Bad and MLK by U2 were just sort of those really captured that
it
time.
It caught them at such a brilliant moment where they were certainly becoming a huge arena band, and they were incredibly experienced at that point. They were on a kind of a make or break album, I think, probably at that time, a sort of homecoming. And I just remember when they took to the stage, and I know that Bono went off, you know, into the crowd, and they were kind of raging with him afterwards because they had to, you know, cut a song. But it was one of the first times that you saw just how good an Irish band could be. Yeah. And I remember just feeling so proud of that. And then years later, I opened in the same stadium for Tina Turner, and I couldn't resist it. I said, please indulge me. Hello, Wembley!
Well, let's have a listen. It's a great track. Your next song, your fourth choice, Brian Kennedy, which was sang on that famous day in London, is Bad by U2. Let's have a listen. I just love that track. Brian Kennedy, yeah. Success like bankruptcy sometimes can come gradually then suddenly.
Okay.
But I remember, I just remember as a young person when you burst onto the
right.
scene and
yes.
everybody fancied you.
But oh, really?
Yeah.
Everybody?
Absolutely. That's
okay.
what I remember from when we
Nobody
were younger.
Nobody really told me that.
Well, there you go. Well, half and Yuri did. But Simon Fuller, of
yes.
Which we know, American Idol, Pop Idol.
Yeah, Spice Girls, Annie Lennox,
Spice,
all of that.
Everything.
Yeah.
He spotted you and took you out of the busking and the pubs and that
yes.
kind of well-worn path.
Yeah.
When you got that success, did you embrace it? Did you want it?
Definitely. Although what you get is not kind of really the version of it that you think it is, because all of a sudden you're on a treadmill. You're running for your life. I was the thinnest I ever was because there was no time to eat. Literally, there was no time to eat. When you're a solo artist, you have to do everything yourself. You're not a band. Everybody wants to talk to the singer. And as you say, the more successful you get, the more people want you. And especially then, the internet was a kind of a burgeoning thing. Back then, we literally got in a van and travelled up and down Ireland and England and Scotland and Wales and talked to everyone in person because it made a difference. And then when the records started to chart as well, there was more pressure to make more records and all of those kind of things. Mm. So, yes, it was a very, very exciting, wild ride, but loads of ups and downs too.
Yeah, no, I can imagine.
Yeah.
We've got so many questions
oh,
coming
good.
In. So many questions. One says, great to hear Brian and these songs on a rainy June day in Dublin. Another one says, I love Brian's music choices. It's great to hear him on the radio and he's also so positive. And one of them said, I hope his health is good
yes,
at the moment.
It
and,
sure is.
You know, people will know that you've, because you've been so
yeah.
courageous and honest about it, but you've had to deal with some really big health issues over
yeah.
the last number of years.
Yeah, my 50s have been very, very challenging. Mm-hmm. You know, rectal cancer and then the challenge of chemo, and then there's a school of thought that that can affect your heart muscle. Then I had a massive heart attack, had to have quadruple bypass.
Quadruple bypass.
Yeah, yeah, that was a shocker. And then terrible COVID after that, when I was wearing the chest brace, you know, because I couldn't stop coughing. So my sternum had been cut in half, you know. So a lot of very, very difficult years. But, you know, like I say, there seems to be a robustness that serves me well. And I don't mean to dilute any of the things that I went through because they were really, really hard. I had to learn to walk again twice in the last 10 years from scratch, from not being able to crawl nearly.
When you're 50s, that's a young man.
You know what I mean? Exactly. And I'm 59. I'll be 60 next year.
Oh,
I'm looking forward to my 60s, I might say that. And now here's the challenge of becoming an actor, of suddenly... you know, becoming
part
of...
You are going to be playing Oscar Wilde.
I'm going to be playing Oscar Wilde.
Is this your debut?
It's my debut acting. I mean, certainly yeah. I did Broadway back in the day with Riverdance on Broadway in America. But this is my first time ever acting as someone else. And the someone else is Oscar Wilde, excuse me.
Which is a big character
yeah,
to take on for
exactly.
your first. It's in Vicar Street next weekend and
yes.
it's with Moonlight. How are you finding that experience? You've been a performer all of your life, but how are you
yeah.
finding that experience and are you good at being directed?
Jason can only answer that question. That's our wonderful director. I've given a lot of support from, I'm delighted to say, Brendan Behan and Phil Lynott, you know, Padraig and Peter. And also, the writing is so beautiful too. So, yeah, I get to sing a couple of songs. I'm in two very, very powerful scenes as Oscar. And I suppose if you want to find out how I cope, please come see the show
and
next Friday and Saturday.
The tickets are available at vickerstreet.com. And I think you can, it is, yeah, on next weekend, June 20th and the 21st. I want to bring you to your final song, but before I do, because it relates to another Belfast native, but someone else, there are a lot coming in, but one said, a friend of mine met Brian Kennedy at a gig in the west of Ireland years ago and was looking for encouragement at the start of his own career. He told me that Brian was kindness and patience personified.
Oh.
He has never forgotten this encounter and wishing Brian continued success in all he does in the future. It wasn't just me. I agree, everyone fancied Brian, said another listener, and I have a great memory of my late moment of friend Mary seeing him go, and he roared up to him to let down his hair, which he did.
Oh yeah.
And you threw them the hair bobbin.
Oh, I probably did.
And
I
they have it
lot.
Brought home, and she said, Janice said she must have worn your hair bobbin on her wrist.
Hilarious.
For
for
about a year. So it wasn't just me.
Well, unbelievably, I still have hair. After all these years, this is my actual real hair.
Yeah, and it's still
post chemo as well.
Yes, yeah, still amazing, not, really. Flowing me in. I want to bring you back to your last song. I better get you to your last song, which is your friend Van Morrison.
You know,
talk
without
to me
whom, there are lots of people in the world discovered me through his music the first time. Days Like This, I think, is one of the pinnacles of the collaborations that we did. It was the 90s, 30 years ago. The other day, I think, the anniversary of this album, a beautiful album. Van's going to be 80, by the way, in August. Can we wish him happy birthday?
We can.
Happy birthday, Van.
Indeed, yeah.
And I'm just so proud to have been part of so many of his albums and so many of the live tours that we did with Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell and Ray Charles.
And he supported you throughout your career.
And even when I got unwell, he sent me a beautiful card. Mm-hmm. He's given me a beautiful signed acoustic guitar of his to auction up, which we will the next time we do an auction. It arrived too late. But I mean, what an incredibly kind, gifted, a really good friend to me, I must say. So I wish him so many birthday wishes. 80 years old. So Days Like This, I love this collaboration.
Well, listen, Brian, Kennedy, it has been an absolute joy chatting to you. Let's listen to your final song. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Here is Van Morrison with Days Like This.
When it's not always raining, there'll be days like this. When there's no one complaining, there'll be days like this. Everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'll be days like this. When you don't need to worry, there'll be days like this. When no one's in a hurry, there'll be days like this.